makes you think.
My pants pirates. We got nothing. We just have to memorize stuff.
I'll memorize it.
Okay, let's go. All right, here we go. We're starting the show. Hey, show. Hey, how's it going?
Good show. You're so funny. Oh,
this is like the best show ever. And by the way, entertaining people and people that are liking it.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Sounds from the 70s with Gary and Rob, also known as the guy who doesn't speak during the introduction. And we are coming to you from a recording facility somewhere that is not in the city where we live, although it is a city of its own, or a town, or hamlet, or who cares? Right, Rob? Who cares?
Who cares?
Who cares?
Oh, I spoke during the introduction. Damn it.
Well, that was the introduction. When I say, hey, Rob, the instruction's over.
Yeah, but what if I'm a young Lee J. Cobb?
Oh, yeah, Lee J. Cobb. I love that. Because you are. You are like a young... I got a story. And I've told this story, but it was like 100 episodes ago.
So you but probably...
I'm watching Hopalong Cassidy, which they don't have on anymore.
No, I don't.
It was about 3 years ago, and I was watching... I always...
You love
I always
Cassidy.
Watched Hopalong Cassidy when I wrote a script or a song. I did, because it was just mindless entertainment that never drew me in, but could get me working. Yeah, you have to understand my brain, which is totally weird in the first place. I'd always have Hopalong Cassidy in the background. It's like having Muzak on, is what I'm saying. And one episode... had the young Lee J. Cobb. And if you don't know who Lee J. Cobb is, then you don't have to listen to this story. But the funny thing about this is that I didn't know that, like, he played he was 32 or 28, something like that. It was a young guy for Lee J. Cobb. He still looked 50. But because that's what they did in those days.
Everybody looked old. He was in his 50s, and he looked 50.
And so he took off his cowboy hat, and a young guy with, like, no hair.
Whoa.
Because Lee J. Cobb later on would wear a toupe or hairpiece or something like that.
Yes.
And it was very rare that he had his like mostly bald head. And for some reason, that has stuck with me for these last 3 years all the time. And it reminds me of Rob anyways, because he looks like a young Lee J. Cobb. Anyways, now last week... if you were unfortunate enough to listen to the beginning of the episode, Rob ruined what many people are calling the greatest joke ever written for this podcast.
That was my best ruination ever.
Now, I don't know if it was the greatest joke, but I do know it was right near the top.
Darn good. And it required timing. That's what I took away.
And then Rob in his, I guess you'd call it selfish. I guess that would be the word, right, Rob? Selfish or stupid? I don't know.
No, selfish implies motivation.
Oh, yeah. Just ignorance, I
guess. Yeah, sure. Absent-mindedness.
Yeah, yeah. You ruined the whole joke and people were bummed. I heard a lot of people were bummed.
It was like I defiled the joke.
You did. It's like you said, "Don't just come over for a drink," and then when the joke got a little bit drunk, you took advantage of it. That's what you did.
All right, joke. You're getting the tongue.
So starting this week, Rob's privileges are taken away. He used at first when we started, he was not allowed to talk during the introduction, and then I gradually let him because he said some kind of funny stuff now and then. Well, once again, he is not allowed to speak during the introduction unless, and this is important, you can speak during the introduction if a madman bursts into the studio to kill me. You can say something to me, okay? Like, oh, he's coming to kill. Oh, look, he's going to kill you.
I'm probably
now,
right after.
You also, you still have to remain silent if the madman comes to kill you. So,
oh yeah, I know.
If a madman bursts into the studio, you have to remain silent until either the introduction is over or you're killed, whichever comes first.
I can't tell him that I think he should shove that puss cake machete up his own.
You have to be quiet until I'm done the introduction, And if I see there's a madman looking to kill you, it might be a long introduction.
I can't call him a big puss cake.
Anyways.
I would.
It's just not, I don't know, like, it's just not, it's not funny. It just doesn't mean anything. It just makes me wish for a monkey. That's all it does. And I bet you people are listening right now going, I didn't like it and I didn't get it.
The important thing is I'm having fun.
Well, now that that is out of the way, today we have our second album we are reviewing. Now I got a puss cake in my head. Such a stupid thing. I don't know. Good job, William B. William. So we have our second album we are reviewing that was produced by Todd Rundgren in the 1970s. And that is Daryl Hall and John Oates, or as Rob calls them, Hoats.
Poets.
I ruined my own. Calls them Oates and Hall.
Oates and Hall.
I don't. Why? How come you don't call them Hall and Oates? I call them. Why do you call them Oates and Hall?
I actually call them Oates and All.
Oates and All.
Oates and All.
You're a rebel. And we will be reviewing their 19. Either a rebel or an idiot. I don't know which one.
A rebel idiot.
Their 1974 album, War Babies. Also known by its working title, Kids with Grenades. Now, speaking, did you get that? War Baby? Okay.
No, I phased out for a second.
Kids with Grenades. I loved that joke when I wrote it. I did. I still like it. I don't think anybody gets it. See, War Babies, Kids with Grenades. Same thing.
Baptism of Fire.
Same thing. Get it? Okay. Anyways. Now, speaking of bombs going off, Rob, how was your week? Lots of fun and frivolity?
I saw people having fun and frivolity down in the park. They were... I didn't actually stop to analyze their activity. I think they were drinking, and they appeared happy. They were smiling, dancing about, touching each other in a familiar way.
Well, that's what you do.
Frequently.
You like to touch yourself.
Yes, but I'm allowed to. I've got my own permission. I have my consent to touch myself in a familiar
Sometimes
way.
You don't. Sometimes you're pissed off at yourself and you won't let yourself touch yourself.
Yeah, but then you just open a bottle of wine, light up some candles, and then it comes back to you like, hey, you person who I should touch, me?
Oh, it was going good there for a while. And then you always take like the wrong road. You know what I mean? You got two roads to go down, and you could go down the road that's going to work, and you said, no, I like this road where it's all bumpy.
No. Let's stop here in the road. Let's stop here and not do it in the road. Let's do nothing in the road. Why don't we do nothing in the road?
Now, today, Rob, oh my God, today we are going to do something special.
How special?
It's too special. Too special for this fucking, I mean, our listeners who we love.
Who we love.
I think that 75% of the listeners we wouldn't mind sleeping with. That's how much we love them. And by sleeping, I mean having sexual intercourse.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant actually sleeping. I'm thinking, what's the bed's not big enough?
Anyways, what we're going to do is we are going to go deep down into the sounds from the 70s vaults to dig out our 1970s record collection that nobody wants.
The unwanted record collection.
These are strange albums found in the place where we moved to, and we can't get rid of them, just like Rob. So
they're just there.
I tell Rob that, you know, let's go do the show Thursday, and I actually go Friday, and he's still there. So we're gonna go over these albums because they're perverse.
they're a little odd. They're a concept odd of the time that I think weren't thought of by artists.
They weren't. This is the 70s are so great because this is the only time that I can think, maybe the late 60s, very late 60s, when these kind of, in the 80s, but the 80s had, they started to become more serious, and they started to become, the 70s had really bad compilation albums, yeah. And really bad, like, that's the Ronco and the K-Tel and all that. Oh my God. And
they just, whatever they can find, they throw it in the salad and eat.
You're going to have to give me a minute while I go way down into the vaults of the sounds from the 70s. Could you talk? Oh, can you hear me, Rob?
I can hear you. I'm trying to.
Can you keep the audience occupied while I get the records?
Well, one thing I want to assure the audience is that all of this time that I spend speaking is completely unrehearsed. I don't think about it before or while I'm doing it.
And oh,
it
just comes and here I come back. Oh, that's the trip down to the vaults is always so tiring.
You should wear a sweater when you go down there. It's so chilly.
Okay. This is my favorite one. This is my favorite one.
A powerful title.
This is a powerful title. This is from Ronco, of course.
Ronco.
I'm gonna look this up, I think, on Discogs while we're doing it. It is called Don Kirshner. We all know Don Kirshner from Don Kirshner's Rock Concerts of the Monkees and blah blah blah. Don Kirshner presents Rock Power.
Rock
Power. Rock Power. Now, what you get, oh man, what you get on this electrifying album of Rock Power with, on the front and back cover, a just steaming hot guitar.
It looks like someone's thrown it after playing a wicked solo.
Just soloing way to beat hell. Thank God the album starts off with the flaming hot Barry White rocking away on Never Never Gonna Give You
Boy,
Up.
There was a time he was played so much on the rock stations, I got sick of him.
And then, of course, the queen of rock, Aretha Franklin, starts off the next song with, of course, the always...
boisterous?
No, was I going to say? The always hot rocking song, You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman. Right. Boy, Don Kirshner's picking some hot tunes. Oh, no, these are actually great tunes, but they're not rock power. We actually got a real rock song here with No More Mr. Nice Guy by Alice Cooper.
Oh, yeah, I can buy that one.
We have... Have I heard this song, Rob? Werewolf by Five Man Electrical Band? I think I have. It was a single, but not very rare. I know Signs, but there's another one, and I think it might be Werewolf.
There was they've had a few.
We got... Fuck, this song is such an instrumentally incredibly powerful tune. I'm glad that Don Kirshner put it on Rock Power. It's the Love Unlimited Orchestra.
Never
heard with of. Yes, we finally made it. And then, of course, on side two, we start off with the always right next to Robert Plant as a screamer and shouter, Al Green.
See, if I was Robert Plant or Al Green Alice Cooper, I'd ask for some clarification as what's the rest of the album going to be like?
You know, and then they actually, and this is true, they have compiled this album and almost put, oh yeah, of course, the rockin' duo of Seals and Crofts with Hummingbird.
Hummingbird. Sounds like a rockin' song.
So they've pretty much stacked the first side and half of the second side with non-rock songs. And then on the very last...
I bet you they close with a rocker.
Yes. All of a sudden, hey, we're ending the album. Let's put some rock songs on there. We got songs by Backwood Turner Overdrive, Let It Ride, and Paranoid by Black Sabbath. See, now this should be all over this record.
Yeah, that is
these
weird
songs. The Faces, Magic Carpet Ride by Steppenwolf, and it ends with the Doobie Brothers' China Grove. Where were these songs for the other first side and half of the second side?
In other words, was it actually Don Kirshner who selected these songs or someone acting on behalf
of him? Or just put his name on it. I'm going to look this up. Do you people mind? We're going to do this next week too because I love this. I love this thing. Okay.
This album is making me angry.
I'm going to put...
I now need answers.
I'm interested. I'm going to go out the Discogs record site here. Or, sorry. Yeah, I guess it's a record site. And I'm going to look this up. And I just want to see... what the kind of information we can find about this scintillating piece of music.
I don't think they know what it exists.
Oh, it's here. It has every album ever. By the way, There's 147 of these albums for sale on Discogs, and the lowest price is 73 cents, about what this copy is worth. And yeah, it was released in 1974 by Ronco. So there you go. And it even says, even though it says the title is Rock Power, it's the style which they put of the record so that people know on Discogs is soul, soft rock, rhythm and blues. Fuck me. That's hilarious. No, you can't get away with this in the 80s or the 90s or any other decade than the 70s.
Can no, you get away even have a judge agreeing with you on that one. He'd like, take those songs off.
Oh, what's this? I love this one.
Oh, wait a second.
I love this one. I love another Ronco one. Ronco presents Get It On.
Get It On! I have a pretty good idea who's going to be on that one. Or what's gonna be. That'll be Barry White. He's on that one.
Now, these are 20 original hits as seen on TV. So this was advertised on TV, of course, from Ronco. Give me you could have got this at a Goodwill store for $1.50. I think overpriced, but there you go. This is not at the time. This is when it was rebought, of course.
Somebody saw that and said, a classic.
So you're looking to just get, I don't know what they mean by get it on. Like get it on like, oh baby, or get it on like we're going to rock, or I don't know what that means.
So get it on, it's got to be oh baby. I'm expecting some sexy songs. Let's hear some sexy songs.
How about, get it on. How about the Farmer's song by Murray McLaughlin?
Farmer has a daughter.
Give me another one. Now you're stretching, buddy. You're stretching. It's got the Lobos. You hate this song, by the way.
I do.
I love you to want me. You hate that song. Rob hates this song. And so do I. Right? I'm not saying that I love this song, but Rob hates it. Do you want me? Now, I don't think of this song coming up as especially...
powerful?
Rocky? Powerful in terms of romantic... the 2001 theme, the also sprach Zarathustra. I don't Gesundheit. Think of that as being a get it on song. They just pick anything. You know what I like though? I think these are the single versions. I can't remember what the Ronco and the Gatel, but they have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. They always have 10 songs aside.
Sounds
and
like
that's
they're
pretty cool.
The shortest possible versions of the songs they could get away with. That's what it sounds like to
let's
me.
Let's just play a minute and 35 of this song.
That's okay, all they need. There, they got the general idea. Good, done.
You know what? As far as what Rob was saying, I don't know what smoking in the boys' room has to do with love or getting it on. You're smoking in the boys' room by Brownsville Station.
You're not smoking cigarettes.
Oh, but what does that have to do? Oh, because you're getting it on. Yeah, you're
getting it on.
Yeah, okay. Actually, most of these songs do kind of cover that. A couple don't. And it ends, again, with a couple songs like the classic Me and Mrs. Jones by Billy Paul. I could do that, but it would be a pale imitation.
They were getting it on.
And of course, it ends with the Ian Thomas song, his first one that came ahead. Painted Ladies and a Bottle of Wine.
I was
Mama.
Just singing that today.
Good song. I like that song. Okay, so let's get it on.
Drinking, thinking, till there was nothing left of me.
Oh, say it again.
Drinking, thinking, till there was nothing left
of
me.
Yeah, it's a good one. What's this? Oh, this has good songs on it. This is Ronco. It's all these Ronco.
20 original hits. Oh, no, it's 22 albums. Original
Let's,
hits.
Maybe we'll see that for next week. Let's try to find something that's not. Here's a K-Tel album. And this one's Wings of Sound. Wings of Sound.
Wings of Sound. That sounds like there'll be a lot of Bette Midler on that one.
Pretty close. Now, this is a little bit more near the... Actually, this is released 1980. So this is 1979 songs, mostly. Now, Wings, this actually is a pretty good album.
There's an Eagles song on it.
No.
Okay.
These are today's original hits and stars. Okay. Now,
when 1979 was today.
1979 was today?
It's not today now.
Okay. So anyways, try to go Rob sometimes. So a lot of these songs, Still by the Commodores, You're Only Lonely, J.D. Souther. These are good songs. Hold On, Ian Gom. I remember that song. It's a great pop song. Do you remember this song? I remember this song. Just When I Needed You Most by Randy Van Warmer. Do you remember that?
Needed you.
Yes. Actually, you know, a sappy song, but has a nice melody to it. Actually, a very nice song. Yeah. Yeah, see, it's a very nice melody, isn't it? I don't make fun of songs just because they're sappy. If they're bad,
if they're bad and sappy.
But that had a nice melody and everything. And I look, and I think Rob does too, we appreciate songs that are nicely written. And even though they may be sappy and not to our taste, you can always say, you know what? That's a great written song. And that's what Just What I Needed You Most is. Please Don't Go by Casey and the Sunshine Band. And then we get, you know what starts side two? Oh, the song that gets under my nails and skin more than any other song. Not Sometimes When We Touch. Oh, I hate that song. But we talked about this a few episodes ago. If You Like Pina Coladas.
Oh, the Pina Coladas song.
Escape.
Yeah.
What's one of some of the worst lyrics and laziest lyrics I've ever had the misfortune of reading on the internet. I listened to them, of course, and I never thought about it because it's one of those songs that you just don't think
about.
Yeah,
it works better in the background than up front.
Exactly.
We'll talk about that.
And more. Of course, we talked about Rupert Holmes being on the Bill Needle show, where he got kicked off. He got kicked off the show because Bill Needle did not like that he was endorsing kids to be drinking pina coladas.
Yeah. He was very conscientious of his audience.
Oh, you don't like this song? I love this song.
No,
why don't you like this song?
This song, I want to just punch a guy in the face.
Cruel to Be Kind by Nick Lowe. Why do you not like this song? I love this song.
Because I'd like to show Nick Lowe some kindness.
Nick Lowe's a great rock and roller. He's a great rock and roller. Here's a guy that I would actually, once you've done beating him up, you would hold him down so I could beat him up.
Yeah, it's like he's saying you got to punch someone in the face to show your love.
And Kenny Loggins.
I don't think you know what kindness or love means.
Yeah, that's what we do, Kenny Loggins, and his song, This Is It.
Oh, This Is It. Okay. Yeah,
although I like the song he did with Stevie Nicks, was it? Whenever I Call You Friend. I like that. He used to play all the time when I was listening to music.
I like the soundtrack for Caddyshack. That was pretty good.
Yeah, that's because I like Caddyshack, though. But that's one guy that is personification of wimp. Like, I'm sorry, I don't use that much because it's a kind of a derogatory word, but that guy could not rock if his rock was already rocking. You understand?
Well, nowadays, he's not known as Kenny Loggins, he's known as K-Log.
Here's a song on I don't listen.
We know. Please, continue.
It's got some good songs on this record. It's got Ain't That a Shame, the live version, of course, from Budokan by Cheap Trick. Very good song and very good version. It's got also two songs on side two by Cheap Trick. The Dream Police.
Oh, they got two.
They're going out of my head. And the one song that Rob stumped me on, or that the radio stumped me on.
That one.
I can name every song from the 50s, 60s, and 70s, at least, that come on the radio. This song came on the radio. And I knew it, but I did not know the artist. Born to Be Alive.
Born to Be Alive.
And this was only a couple of years ago. And maybe more than that, but not too long ago.
It was because it was on that car commercial.
Yeah, because I remembered it from the car commercial, but it never really played on the radio over here.
No.
So it was one of the few artists that I didn't. I can name artists like, I just said Ian Gom. People say, who the fuck's that? I know Hold On. If I heard Hold on the radio, I'd say, that's Ian Gom. I can do that for almost any artist, seriously. And Rob has seen it.
I'm afraid
Patrick Hernandez, I drew a blank. I know it now by heart now, but at the time, Rob was even like, you didn't know that?
I was singing it there, and you're like, yeah, that's not a song.
And I was embarrassed because that was like the first time, like, I did not know who did that song.
Wings of Sound. See, I'd be expecting to find Paul McCartney on there.
Ah, so would I. Wings of Sound, yeah. Actually, looks like a very good album. Not misleading. I find K-Tel to be not misleading and Ronco to be extremely
misleading. Bunch now, of lying bastards is what they are.
To end this for this week, I just want to talk. Does anybody remember out there, because you know our listeners are not exactly 20-year-olds, but my parents had quite a few of these albums that they used to do where, God, they must have been cheap, where they would have the hits of the day, but they'd be performed by a studio band.
Other artists.
So they'd be like $1, and you could get the hits of the day. And actually, Elton John, they actually have an album of his out where he did that. He was one of those people who sang on the hits in Britain. I think that's where it started. I don't know if this happened in the States, but it was very popular in Britain and Canada, where they would replicate the hit songs without having to pay for the, you know, the licensing and all that stuff, by getting studio musicians to reproduce it as closely as they could to the original. And my parents had three or four of them. My brothers may have bought them, because my older brothers were really, and my parents were not musical.
Not the hippest music.
No, they really had no interest in it, to be honest with you. It was only my brother and I at the end, the last two, who really had a passion for it. So they didn't care. They didn't care that it wasn't the original artist. But of course, they've kind of still do that in a way. I remember my niece, well, this was a long time ago, 10, 15 years ago, was telling me about these kids. I can't remember, the Kids Inc. or something like that, who would do the songs for like 10-year-olds, 9 and 10-year-olds.
Oh, yeah. They do the songs that they did the higher voice, though.
Yeah. Yeah. So you knew that they weren't, of course, the original songs, but they would relate more to the kids that were really young than they would by the original artists. I understand that. But they haven't done anything where they actually say, listen. And they would say, these are not the original artists or whatever. And I don't know. It's just nowadays when you think of it, it just seems incomprehensible, because it was so bad.
Blasphemy.
Yeah, like why can't you just get that recording and do what Ronco and Keitel did? And I don't even know what labels there are on these crappy records, but I'm glad labels. that part
pirate labels,
that part of the record industry is no longer, but it got there were a couple of other people who got their start playing on that record. I can't name them off the top of my head, but there were a couple of others who played on the records. Elton John actually sang a lot of the songs that he had to sing. You got paid a certain amount for doing a session or whatever, and when you're a starving musician, and they released a whole album of him doing all these hits from the 69 or whatever. So I just want to see if it, I know Rob remembers it, and God, we had, you know, the reason why we had these albums and started not to in the 80s was because we were still in a single format a lot of times. So you'd buy a single and you'd want the whole, you'd want like, oh, I'd want like 20 songs, but I don't want to buy a whole album.
Yeah, yeah.
And stuff like that. So they would put everything on, on one of these Ronco and Keitel albums.
People wanted music, but were not serious.
They were not serious enough to buy a whole album.
Yeah.
And nowadays, of course, you got streaming. You can pick songs everywhere. Every song is available almost.
Yeah, there's no albums anymore.
There's no albums
anymore.
You can
say there's albums, but no.
And even in the 80s, they still had them in the 80s, but they weren't as strong, because now you could like take it from the library and tape songs and put it on cassettes.
Yeah.
Cassettes changed things a lot.
The fact that you
cassettes
could,
made where you could put it on cassettes.
Stuff home.
Yeah. You could actually. Well, I'm going to go back into the vaults.
Going back.
I'm almost there.
Darned old records that don't belong to us back in the vault, and then.
Can you hear me, Rob? I'm coming back up the stairs.
I can, and it's not actually our vault. it's a vault.
You couldn't call it, even though I called it the Sounds from the 70s Vault. It's not legally ours.
Yeah.
And if you want to look up those records like I did, please do. The records, I forget now, Wings of Destiny.
Wings of Power.
You can look up Don Kirshner Presents Rock Power. And the other one, I don't know, what was it, Get It On? Or something like that.
Get It On.
If you want to look it up on Discogs, we're not bullshitting you. These are actual albums, and they are on Discogs. Every album is on Discogs, except sometimes the one we're looking for when we're doing a show. Yeah, well, sometimes I'm looking for an album cover to put on the thing.
Nothing.
And it's like, they didn't shoot an album cover for that one. They just released the record. Discogs, by the way, is I'm joking because Discogs have I don't know how they have all those records. I don't know how they came up with it. But
there's a collector. Kudos to them. Yeah.
I go to them all the time, especially now. The last 4 years that we've done this show, the times. If I got charged for all the times I went to Discogs, I'd be charged a lot. I'd be paying a lot of money.
Yeah. You can't afford a lot of money.
Did I say I could?
I think you did. You implied it.
Did I? Sorry, people. I can't afford to go to Discogs if they charged all the time. How do we get on that, you idiot?
That's right. We got stuff to talk about.
Okay. So today's album we are reviewing is... Oh, I'm so thirsty. Is one... we had pizza before the show, and that really makes me thirsty.
The only thing that makes him more thirsty than pizza is the caviar. He loves the caviar.
And we had caviar before the show like we always do, and that just makes it worse.
The good Iranian stuff.
Today we are reviewing... We are reviewing one of the strangest records, not strange, it's maybe most controversial records from the 70s. It's not because it's weird or anything like that. It's weird because of the group that's doing it. It's Hall & Oates' 1974 album War Babies, produced by Todd Rundgren. And very interesting. Even when I knew very little about music in the late 70s, 77, and 78, and Hall & Oates was being played all the time on the radio. They would always mention like War Babies, but they would never play anything from it. They made this album, which is too strange to be played on the radio. And why did they do that? And so it became kind of like, this mysterious album that what were they thinking? One of those, what are they thinking albums? You know, what were they thinking at the time? But anyways, we'll get to that in a second. Let's do a little bit. You all know about Hall & Oates, but just quickly, I did not know that Daryl Hall was born Daryl Franklin Hoyle.
Hoyle.
Yeah, interesting. And John William Oates were born within a year and a half of each other. Daryl was born in Pottstown, Pennsylvania, and John Oates was born in New York City. And they first met at the Adelphi Ballroom in Philadelphia in 1967. You remember that. Not the event, but you remember being in Philadelphia in 1967.
Well, we rented that for a gig, and we got the money to save the orphanage, but then we got thrown in jail afterwards.
Yeah, it's the Blues Brothers. Anyways, at the time they met, each was doing different things, but they were both doing like soul things. They were doing which became known later on, of course, Blue-Eyed Soul, which is something almost they themselves, I'm not saying they did it, but with the help of a few other artists, they kind of invented the blue-eyed soul, which is the white man's soul music. They kind of played this gig, kind of met, blah, blah, blah. And then they kind of moved in together to kind of share their, because they had no money and they wanted to share their musical dream. And on one of their apartments they shared, they had Hall & Oates on the mailbox, which became the duo's nickname from people. Oh, it's Hall & Oates. Oh, it's Hall & Oates.
And it makes it easier to send them stuff too.
Yeah, we're going to send it to Hall & Oates. It took them another 2 years, though, from 1967 to 1969 to actually form a musical duo. I think because they were in separate bands, is what I'm saying.
Okay.
And then to actually say, okay, I actually finally quit this band and blah, 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 and they became a musical duo. And 3 years after that, in 1972, they signed to Atlantic Records, of course, Ahmet Ertegun, and released their debut album, which was called Whole Oats, which was a very folk type of album. It combined other things, but mostly their album. And that's very interesting because their first album was very folky, called Whole Oats. Their second album, Abandoned Luncheonette, which would eventually is generally regarded as their best album ever. was very R&B, Blue-Eyed Soul. And then their next album, all for Atlantic, they did three albums for Atlantic before they moved on to RCA, was War Babies. It was right after Abandoned Lunch Now. Three different musical styles and three albums. And War Babies was glitter rock, very rock and roll, very out there.
Had more of the rock feel to it, yeah.
Very rock. As rocking as Hall & Oates has ever gotten before or after, by far. None of the first three albums were very successful at all. And they did have a small hit single with She's Gone from Abandoned Luncheonette. But the interesting thing is, after making three albums, Atlantic let them go because they weren't selling enough. And RCA picked them up. And then they made in 1975 their self-titled album, which is called the Silver Album because it's all silver. And they look like chicks on the cover. They really do. Not that they're dressed like chicks, you got to see the album cover.
Yeah, even with the mustache.
Yeah, and he did. And then when that album was released, another Blue-Eyed Soul album, Sarah Smile became a hit single. And when that became a big smash, they re-released She's Gone, and it became the classic that it is now known as. So it was actually released twice as a single. The first time did okay. Second time, 2 years later, became huge, and Hall & Oates was forever like big after that. The next year, they released Bigger Than Both of Us, which had my favorite Hall & Oates song on it, which is Rich Girl.
The most successful duo in all of galactic history.
The Candace, you know, and they've written, gone up all the way to number 14 this week.
That's where I heard a whole bunch of those. Casey Kasem.
And you know, the funny thing about Hall & Oates is that Daryl Hall once killed a man in a fit of anger. But you know, that's what you got to do sometimes to get on the top of the charts. Good for you, Daryl.
Which is where they are now. Number 4 with their song.
Love Casey Kasem. Casey, you're the man. Anyways, and I do a good Casey Kasem. I have to admit, I don't do a lot of good stuff.
He educated us at a formative time.
Yeah, he did. And so that brings us back. Because after they did She's Gone and Sarah Smile and especially Rich Girl, which was huge. They never looked back after that.
That's the one song I really like of theirs.
Yeah, Rich Girl is my favorite song by them. I think it's the perfect. Again, I got a lot of perfect pop songs or rock songs because I say it a lot on here. But actually, when I think of it, out of the millions and millions of songs, there's not many that I think are absolutely perfect. And Rich Girl, I love songs that whatever they do in the song is right.
Yeah, that's one Rich Girl. Everything worked out in it.
Yes, yeah. every musical choice, every word, every drum fill, every guitar part that they decided to put in.
Every piano chord, it perfect.
Perfect, yes. The length of it. On this one, on Rich Girl, which was very short. I always thought there was a long version of Rich Girl. Yeah. But it's not. It's only 2 minutes. And so I always, in fact, as a kid, and I heard this song, I always thought, and you did, you just said so, yes. I always thought it was about 4 minutes long because it felt, and I don't mean it's in a derogatory way, it felt like 4 minutes because it was so big.
When we started doing this album, that was the first thing I thought, I had, okay, I'm going to find that song and have a listen to it. And I think it's 2 minutes and 22 seconds.
It's so very short. Yeah. And it still shocks me because when I found that out many, many years ago, I thought, well, that must be the single version. What's the album version? Oh, that's the same. Really, they pack so much into that it feels longer. And in a good way, it feels like, wow, that's all I can take because they've done so much with it. And yet it's only past 2 minutes, which is sometimes shorter than songs in the 50s.
It's very deceptive. Like
very deceptive. Brilliant song.
You have to actually see it written down the time and realize.
Now that makes it interesting because that's Hall & Oates. That's the Hall & Oates we all know. The She's Gone and the Rich Girl and this perfect pop group that you can't knock because they make these great songs and the great singing of Daryl Hall. And then they make this album. which people still don't know why they made this album the way that they did. I guess they wanted to work with Todd Rundgren, which was one thing. And but they had just made what many people still consider their best album ever. It got a lot of critical reviews at the time with Abandoned Luncheonette. They actually got on their second album their musical, what do you call it? Their musical foundation that they would build upon, and then they left, which was strange. That's really weird. And they kind of said, okay, now let's try something new. And yet they found something that it takes some bands, you know, years to figure out, oh, this is what we should be playing. This music fits us perfectly. They kind of found it on Abandoned Luncheonette, and then they kind of said, okay, let's do something else. But we still don't know in any real form how this started to work and go like 180 degrees with this album and work with Todd Rundgren. And to be perfectly honest, to make an album that sounds exactly like a Todd Rundgren album, but not too much like a Hall & Oates album, that's still not a knock. I'm not knocking it yet. If I do, I'm just saying that, and I do agree with some people who I have read over the last week who have said, oh, this just sounds like a Todd Rundgren album, except with Hall & Oates singing. That I kind of agree with, and I kind of don't. What I agree with is it could very easily be a Todd Rundgren album if Todd put his vocals on it, but it does have Hall & Oates songs on there.
And the songwriting is different.
And
yes.
The songwriting is by Hall & Oates, and it does sound, they are very distinctive songwriters, and it's just that the music itself and the little things that are put in there sound very Todd Rundgren. So I think people who look at it at a face value level say, oh, it's very much just a Todd Rundgren album with Hall & Oates singing on it and stuff. And I said, that's kind of true if you're not looking deep into it and not a big rock fan.
Yeah.
But if you really look into it, it's just a Hall & Oates album that is heavily produced by Todd Rundgren, which means his signature stuff is all over there.
Yeah, I mean, George Martin added a lot to the Beatles' music. He didn't play any of the tracks, I don't think, but...
Well, he played on a few tracks, yeah.
Well, that's right. He played keys on a few
keyboards
tracks.
Keyboards on a few tracks. He wrote...
And he wrote all the... that's what I mean, is he
string
added
scores,
all the scores to it, but...
Exactly. Yeah. And Todd Rundgren. And, of course, it sounds a lot like Todd Rundgren because he uses a lot of his band Utopia on this record, which just formed. And Todd plays almost all the guitar solos on this album. Great guitar solos, too. Almost all the guitar solos
that's
are exemplary.
One thing that really grabbed me was every time the guitar came on in a solo.
I have to admit, wow. I think the guitar solos are the thing that sticks out for me on this album right off the bat. If I had to say, well, if somebody asked me, like you, you know, what's the thing that you remember from War Babies? Like, oh, the guitar solos. They were just phenomenal.
So the first listen, I was listening to the guitar solo would come in here and there, and I'm like, hey, man, that's pretty cool. And it was like halfway through the album, I remembered, oh, yeah, Todd Rundgren produced this, so he probably played guitar.
But you never know because... you know, bands have their own guitar players.
But I got a pretty good idea because the wah, the fuzz, the choice of notes.
Oh, yeah, the choice of notes, the sound of his guitar. Very easily Todd Rundgren identifiable. But it's not a given just because Todd Rundgren produced, because a lot of people come in with their own musicians and then he tells them, okay. Sometimes I bet with Todd Rundgren, he says, listen, I got this solo. I can play it really good. And then he does, you know.
Yeah.
And that I can see. But he played, except for one song... that had another guitarist play the guitar solo. He played every solo on this record. And he didn't... You know what I like is that he didn't just say, I'm going to blow off... it's not my album. I don't want to waste this great guitar solo on something that's not my album. But he didn't. Every guitar solo on here is pretty exemplary.
Yeah, he brought his A-game.
He brought his A-game to the production and to his playing. And... What did I want to say before I really got into the analysis of the album? Oh, I just wanted to say, people may say, oh yeah, but Todd Rundgren albums, wouldn't they sound like Todd Rundgren? No. Because we reviewed the first album that Todd Rundgren produced, we've already reviewed, which was in 1970, the Great Speckled Bird album from Ian and Sylvia. Sounded nothing at all like Todd Rundgren. In fact, it sounded like he was only 20 years old. I don't even know why he got picked to produce the album, except that he lived in Bearsville in Woodstock, which was the label Bearsville of Ian and Sylvia and Albert Grossman, the famous manager of Dylan and Ian and Sylvia and Gordon Lightfoot and whatever, was also his manager. So maybe he just said, you produce it. Because it didn't sound like he did anything except move the knobs that needed to be moved. Because there's no Todd Rundgren producing stuff on that at all.
On that album, nothing at all.
Nothing. No Todd Rundgren. Very good point. No Todd Rundgren signature sound on any of that album. I think when the third time I listened to it, when we reviewed it, had to remind myself, oh yeah, that's right, Todd Rundgren produced this album, just for the show to remember. But it hardly got brought up when we reviewed it because it was so, it could have been produced by anybody.
Yeah.
And so, yes, some albums he can hide. Some albums, and we will do an album next week that, again, sounds very Todd Rundgren. And there are some albums that he clashes a lot because some people want the Todd Rundgren genius, but they don't want, it sounded like a Todd Rundgren record. And that has come up with a lot of divisions with some bands, which makes reviewing Todd Rundgren a lot of fun. Because I don't think a lot of people would know that Bad Outta Hell sounds, because it doesn't sound like Todd Rundgren. And people would have a hard time thinking, oh, Todd Rundgren produced that? I mean, I think if you say it, you go, oh yeah, it's big and bombastic. Oh yeah, you know, a lot of effects in there. But at first, there's no way you would think that that's produced by Todd Rundgren. So he has the ability not just to make stuff that sounds like him, is what I'm trying to say. But this one does. This one, and I have a feeling, and both Daryl and John do not disown this album. There has been rumors that just because the album doesn't do well or it's a real shift in their musical direction, that they must not like it. No, they actually like this album. They don't disown it at all. They like working with Todd Rundgren and they like the album, and they've never said anything bad about it. It just didn't do well and it had no singles on it. And so it was just an experiment that was fun to do, but it didn't go anywhere. And there is no real controversy about the record other than from the public listening to it going, oh my God, why does it sound so different? You know how the public gets.
That's not the Hall & Oates from the second album. And the second album isn't the Hall & Oates from the first album.
They must have been coerced into making this album, because what's going on? And none of that happened. It was just they wanted to work with Todd Rundgren, and I think they probably wanted to make a rock record. And that's sometimes there is no story. Sometimes you think that there's a story in a controversial record, and the only story is that it's controversial because the people who are listening to it make it controversial.
I think they just did it because it's what they felt they had to do at the time. So.
I think so. There has never been a real explanation, but they've never apologized for it.
No, they shouldn't. It's a cool kind of musical experiment.
It is. It's a cool album. and it's a very 70s album. You don't hear this album in the late 60s, and you don't hear this album even in the late 70s or early 80s. This is a great time period album. They got nothing to be ashamed of, and they don't have to describe. And I think they have described how they do it. It's simple. We just wanted to work with Todd Rundgren to make a rock album. Wow. We want more, though. Sorry, there's no dirt on this one. You want dirt, you're going to the wrong place. Because people bring this up all the time. People like strange albums from... They like when weird artists make straight albums. And they like when straight artists make weird albums.
If you make a weird album, you've got to have a reason for it.
Yes, there has to be.
What's this amazing reason?
Who made you do it? No, nobody made me do it. Well, then why'd you do it? Were you under financial pressure?
A weird trip? What happened?
Exactly. And yet there's nothing about this other than they wanted to do it. And there was no conflict in making it. They got along well with Todd Rundgren, who can be very hard to get along with sometimes. But there was nothing. In fact, Daryl Hall just toured with Todd Rundgren a couple of years ago. They toured together, so obviously there's no hard feelings at all. I like this record. I've heard this record a couple of times before we reviewed it over the last 10 or so years. Always an album I wanted to listen to and finally got to. about 8 or so years ago, and I liked it the first time and first couple times. And this week, I enjoyed it every time I put it on. It's not a classic, excellent record, but it is a extremely interesting record. Like I say, very much a time capsule of what you could do back then that you sure can't do now, because it would be labeled alternative and way too strange. It's kind of like taking Hall & Oates songwriting and subverting it a little, but just still, every song is not weird. It's just kind of made a little bit different because of the Todd Rundgren production.
Yeah, no, it's not. I didn't find anything weird. It was
right,
but it wasn't straight ahead rock. Some of the parts, some of the playing was straight ahead rock, but the songwriting was not.
The songwriting was basically Daryl Hall and John Oates songwriting, and just rocked up a little bit, and with some Todd Rundgren strange flourishes.
Yeah, and some of those instrumental breaks and bridges were pretty cool.
Oh yeah, the breaks and bridges are the ones that are really Todd Rundgren's forte, and the beginnings of songs.
Yeah,
you know, and that's where it all comes in. And yes, the end project, you kind of go, oh, that's kind of weird and strange. But it's really not. It's just that it's not what's heard of nowadays, and probably not heard too much then.
No.
But yeah, it just sounds very alive. That album sounds alive to me. It sounds very 70s. There's a sound around 73, 74 that's very about the glitter period. It's very alive, you know.
Yeah,
in this, you know?
The kind of multi-track recording in that had been more or less perfected by this point. And,
yes.
It was past its experimental stages.
They kind of knew what they were doing at this point.
Yeah, especially that's why a lot of bands kind of flourished with really great recordings at this
time. Yeah, this is a really good recording. Like, this sounds really good. It's really hard to make an album sound alive, especially when there's a lot of little experimenting going on, but they did it here. It sounds really alive and vibrant. And you get that through the whole record. The first side is basically songs about being a musician or being in a band, either successful or not, or about the 70s. Mostly it's about being a rock musician, or any musician, I guess. You get a couple songs like that on the second side, but then you get three songs on the second side that kind of divert from that subject. It's really an album about, I guess, musicians in the 70s and basically life in the 70s. Like, the song 70s Scenario is basically about life in the 70s, what the 70s were like, which were so different. I saw on YouTube, and I can't remember. I just see so many things that I, you know, that I watch for the show and stuff like that to get myself prepared. So sometimes I can't remember who it was. But they were talking to somebody, and they were saying, oh, the 60s. It seems like every decade, and I've said this before, I'm just glad somebody validated it. He said every decade since rock and roll started had its own aura about it. It seems like as soon as the 50s ended, the 60s started, and it had a whole aura about it.
Had
as
a twangy, surfy kind of feel to it.
It had
shifted into a psychedelic feel.
You could almost smell it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you could feel it when you listen to the songs. And then as soon as the 60s end, almost right in 1970, you could feel the music change.
Polished and stereo and...
And of course, the carpeting sound, I said, for some records, and for good or for bad. Sometimes it's great. But you definitely... I can tell a song...
The decade.
From almost the year.
Yes.
Because of what I hear of the drum sound, I have been able to do this, and people think it's amazing. I can hear a song on radio that I haven't heard... they'll play me a song, or they'll just play a song, and they'll say, can you guess the year? They won't say the artist, because sometimes they won't let the voice come in.
They'll just
let the music, and I'll hear the sound of the piano, and I'll hear the sound of the drums, and I'll go, I bet you that's around 72, 73. And they'll go, yeah. Almost every, I can tell, and I think, and I'm not just saying it, because I can do it. People who listen to music a lot can do this. You can hear a sound that's from 73 compared to 76 to 78.
You can also hear sounds that you know didn't exist before a certain time.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. So you get fooled by somebody trying to sound like it's 1968, but you go, no, it sounds like 1968, but this sounds like more like 1968
style writing and singing, but the production and the actual instrumental sounds.
Oh, yeah, true. Yeah. And the guy said at the end, every decade it's been like that. It's had its own ambience, its own smell, its own feeling, its own sound, except when it came into to the 2000s. And yeah, that's when everything started to get just... Because humans stopped playing.
I guess so.
Simple. It became... Pop music became... I'm talking about mostly about pop music when we get into the aughts, because rock and roll made by...
Yeah, I think I was telling you our...
Poor rock musicians.
Our keyboard player replaced all his keyboards with an iPad.
Yeah. So it's not being played by pop music that's heard on the radio. And I'm not going to get into knocking it or anything on today's show. Because everybody's got their point of view. But we're just saying that it doesn't have a feel. You could hear a song from 2002 and it could be from 2022. Because yeah, they all have the same... You don't have the human factor involved of trying to get the room ambience or anything, because it's going straight from the machine to the board.
Yep.
Machine to the board. There's no air. And he made that point too, which I've said
before. We don't need sound engineers anymore.
Yeah.
We don't need guys to engineer ways to get sounds onto records.
Exactly. And the reason we're harping about this is because this album has a sound to it. You can hear the air. You can hear the energy. Even if it's manufactured.
Yep.
It doesn't matter, because you can feel the energy from song one to the end, and the feeling that they want you to have is aliveness and everything and energy. And then when you're done, you go, wow, that was a really peppy album. And I mean that in a nice term. I don't mean like, oh, it's so peppy. I mean, it's peppy, like in it makes me feel good. Like, wow, that was a bright album. That was, you know, and a really good production. And I swear anybody who listens to this would say that about the sound of it. And I don't know. The problem, of course, with this album is there is no hit singles. Like, there is nothing to me that stands out as a signal, which, of course, doomed this record not to sell. I could maybe pick a song. I would pick Can't Stop the Music. He played it much too long as a single, which they did. But I actually would pick that song. I don't just like the song. It didn't do anything in it. I knew if I picked that song, it probably wouldn't do it. If they said to me, Gary, what's the song that we should release? I'd say the Can't Stop the Music song, but I don't think it'll sell. It's just...
Yeah, let them know up front.
It's just the most commercial song on an uncommercial type album, I would tell them. But you know what? The album is really good, so don't worry about it. You know, people will catch up to it. Probably won't even sell good now, boys, but it'll make its money back eventually. And I said it's a good artistic statement. That's basically what I have to say about this album. There are some songs I really like, though, like Beanie G and the Rose Tattoo, which is really cool because it's very ahead of its time, because it's about a guitar player named Beanie G who's very technically gifted, but puts no heart and soul into it.
He's got no soul.
And the Rose Tattoo is his guitar. And so it just, as soon as I heard it, it reminds me of like, hate to name names, but...
Bunch of people we played with.
A bunch of people we play, but also...
I'm not going to name one. I'm going to say that a few.
The people like Yngwie Malmsteen and the people who play fast, but I listen to them and I don't get moved by them. That doesn't do anything for me.
They're technically really good.
Yes, yeah. That's exactly what came to my mind when I heard Beanie G and the Rose Tattoo. And this is before this kind of happened. Obviously, this is 1974. So a little forward thinking here... I don't think, of course, Daryl Hall meant it like that, but it turned out to be like that. These guitar players who played with all the technique, but no heart. And at least to me, when I listen, I know a lot of people feel that way too, but a lot of people love these fast guitar players and God bless them. But I get killed by a note sometimes.
Oh yeah.
Just a note. Side one is the most commercial of the two sides. Side two gets a little weird in a good way, but it's, you know, You're Much Too Soon by Daryl Hall. He sings, he always sings good, but he just sings so fabulous on this record. It's almost breathtaking. I'm Watching You, which is a really strange song because it's a song about, from the second side, it's a song about a video, I guess you would call it back then, just a camera. That looks nowadays, where there's everywhere, right? There's cameras out in the street looking at everybody, but pretty novel back then. And this camera goes on the same street, and there's this hooker, I guess. And this camera falls in love with the girl who's the hooker, and kind of just a saying, I love you, and but I'm a camera. Sounds weird, but actually works really well. Screaming Through December is a really strange song, but again, it's only strange because Todd Rundgren made it strange, because it's actually really nice first couple of... I'm not knocking the strangeness either. I'm just saying that it kind of ruins the song if it ever had any chance of being a single because of that, but it has a very
weird
nice verses and chorus to it. Yeah, it goes into really weird
talking part, yeah.
And also like the last song written by Hall & Oates, Johnny Gore and the Sea Eaters. I'm just guessing what the sea means in Eaters. I think it's like the you think about it hard enough.
I think it's the musical note C.
Okay. So basically, I really like this album. I think it's never going to be, for a lot of people, an excellent album. I know some people will think it's an excellent album, but to me, I find it hard for this to be an excellent album just because there's so much going on, and there's a lack of commerciality to it that kind of... You think it's really going to work, and then a little bit of strangeness goes in there that kind of throws you off a little bit. But it's a fascinating record. It's continually fascinating every time I listen to it. I never get bored of this record, and I've heard it now about 6 times in my life. And I give it 3.5, which is very good. I think it's a very good record. And I think if it would have been toned down, which I'm not saying it should have because it was an artistic statement, but I think if it would have toned down, it probably would have gotten a 4 stars, which is an excellent from me. But it is what it is, and I like it what it is.
It's a kind of a neat thing.
You know, that's a neat thing.
I was less enthusiastic about it.
Oh, really?
My the initial comment was it was musically interesting but lyrically flat. And the lyrics, once again, bugged me.
Really?
They didn't really make me angry, but they didn't reach me. And the more I listened to it, the more things I had to say.
Really? Would you say the more you listened to it, the less you liked it?
Yeah. I think I was... earlier, I was saying the other one we were talking about where it was probably better as background music than front music. I find this is better as background music than upfront music.
Wow. I can see that for the lyrics.
If you're going to put words in there, I thought the words were... maybe I should just read my comments. They sound acerbic.
Shall I read them? Well, you wrote it, so that's probably how you feel.
Vague hipster lyrics that no real human would use, not in this volume anyway, completely failed to grab me. Well, and not all of them, a few of them did, but not enough. And I found myself in the song looking forward to the instrumental breaks there. One thing that really bugged me about the songwriting and the lyrics was that most of the songs had a part where they would just take one or two lines and repeat them, and not build, they would just repeat them. That drove me crazy. That drove me wacky crazy. It's like all these songs are, 30% longer than they need to be.
So that's the song I didn't like. You know what, man? I hate to throw this, all over the place. But you know what band that does that a lot? What you just said? That as a kid, and they were first coming out, used to bug the shit out of me. I get used to it now. And I love them. I think they're one of the greatest bands ever. But... The Police used to do it all the time, where they would repeat everything and repeat everything and repeat everything over and over. And I, even as a young kid, 79, 80, I would only be not just entering teenage, just being a teenager, and already I was an experienced listener. I would go, wow, they repeat stuff too much to make this song a minute longer. And it's funny you brought that up, because every time somebody says that, I think of The Police, because almost every song that they released as singles went on that I thought too long. I have learned to actually got used to that as far as The Police is concerned. They but I identify exactly parts, what you're saying.
But they built it really subtly.
Yes.
They just, I didn't hear too much building in this. It just, to me, these two lines are being repeated and then repeat them and then they repeat them.
Yes.
It's like, is it coming you up? Know what? Is I it didn't going notice down?
That. I didn't notice that, but if you did, obviously it's
that's,
there.
Yes, that's frequent on a... I'm trying to think. There's probably about three or four songs that don't have that happen.
You actually brought up something which is a big point for both of us and an album, which I don't think too much of. I only think of it in the love song thing. I think of it a lot, which is what you said about saying things that people wouldn't say.
Oh, using language that real people would never use. I mean, occasionally.
You know that's a big bug for us. You know
yes,
that is.
Yes, that's like you're trying to sound like someone you're not. You're trying to...
Now...
I understand putting on a character. Yeah. I understand that.
See, that's why it doesn't bug me almost at all
okay.
with this.
If you
because
get into
first
the
it's artistic.
If you
it's
get
artistic,
into the,
what, yes.
the characters, yeah, okay.
I'm thinking of Benny G., as a character, I'm thinking of the characters as rock stars. Other than like where you got the love song thing, where you got the sometimes when we touch, and there's stupid lyrics that nobody would would say, or words that phrases that nobody the would actually, say to a person.
Okay, I'm not knocking these because they don't make sense. That's not the case.
I'm not saying that those don't make sense. I'm just saying that I found a difference between. Sometimes when we touch,
some of those lyrics completely don't make sense.
They don't make sense, and you wouldn't say
the
them.
Honesty
you
is
actually,
too much.
They sound the great in the song because it makes girls go, "Oh, I love that song," but it's
he
not
used
reality.
That word honesty, and he used yeah. the word feelings, and
yes, and they say the stupidest stuff. We talked about this with Pina Colada. No. How I said you would never say that to your wife. You would never say that, and it is a big point for both of us. I can lose that inhibition when it comes to an artistic album, when it's not about love songs and you can get into the characters. So you're
yes.
right, I can do that, but I can understand how
if you can't
it can
get
bug
into the
you.
Characters.
It can bug
yeah,
you to the point.
Can.
Yeah.
I kind of liked War Babies. That was the one song on it that I kind of liked.
That's funny. That's the one song I
you didn't like.
I didn't like. I didn't think it didn't move me at all. Like at all. And I just thought it was strange for strange purposes. And it's funny because I was thinking, I bet you
I
he says he likes War Babies
as the lyrics song. And musically, I kind of liked it more than a lot.
See,
of
it's so strange. We're really starting to get really opposite views here because I thought War Baby was both. A little bit too smartsy pants musically, and I also thought that it was too smartsy pants lyrically, and both together really didn't work for me. So we're really kind of separating here. I actually thought we'd really like this together. I really did. As you know, as people know, every week I try and guess if we're going to agree, if Rob's going to hate it, if I'm going to like it, and I really did thought I would have bet $5,000 that you were going to say almost the same as I did, but a little bit different. I didn't think that you would break. So damn on me for being wrong.
No, the lyrics bug me.
Really? Okay.
They
no, I mean, I understand
angry.
It.
I just found that they seemed very stocky to me in that stock. I've heard a bunch of these kind of phrases used before in other songs and used better.
It's a good point, though. It is a good point.
But
what was the other point? Oh, yeah, the songs going... See, I never noticed this. So, of course, it wasn't a problem with me, but I do understand the problem of repeating things to make them too long. Yes.
Yeah. And it wasn't like it was even a fade-out or anything. It was just repeated, and then they do another verse, and then the chorus, and then they'd get on this this two-line thing repeating it, and... I'm watching you. I like the first half of that song, but it kind of lost me as it was going away. And the rest, I was struggling for things to enjoy on this album.
Really?
Yes.
I'm interested. To cut right to the chase. You can still talk about it afterwards, but I'm really interested in what you give this record. Well, you should know before you say now. Let me
I
think.
Do. I have it written down.
Okay. Well, just tell me what it is. So don't.
This is not a reflection of the quality of the album. This is the reflection of my feelings on it. I gave it a 1.5.
Holy fuck!
Yes.
You know what I say about albums that I give a 1.5?
And I was trying to find stuff to like about it, and I was struggling.
You
it's
are
like,
very
I don't
kind.
Like this part. I don't to like
reviewing
that part.
An album that you give. You've heard the kind of yes, vitriol that I speak about albums that I give 1.5. So I'm actually quite surprised.
This is not a case of hate or anything making me angry. This is just...
Actually, I did that. You know what? I take that back because the Don Everly album, which I thought was extremely interesting, but didn't work on any of the levels that he was looking for. I gave 1.5, but it was kind of a good review. And this is, and I'm not saying yours is a good review, but it's the same thing where I tried, I liked what he was doing and the experiment, but it didn't work. And I think that in a way is what you're saying. Like you're saying, I like that Todd Rundgren's producing it. I like that Hall & Oates is going out on the limb here, but that doesn't mean it works.
Yes. It is an experimental album, and I still think it's a cool experiment. But, you know, I liked the instrumental breaks. There were a few lines or verses that, very few that grabbed me. Guitar solos caught me first early on. I like Daryl Hall's voice. I think he's got a
it's
really
always
good voice.
The thing that if anybody knocks Daryl Hall's voice, then they're obviously not listening to the record. I mean, that's a given. That's like saying, you know, Pavarotti's a hack or something. I mean, it's just a stupid comment if somebody says, you know, the weakest part of this album is Daryl, unless he had laryngitis when he was singing on the album.
Well, I knew Hall & Oates from the early 80s and that, and some of the pop songs they were doing then that I didn't actively dislike them. I just assumed, you know, that when you hear it on the radio, it was music for other people. It wasn't for me.
No, it wasn't for us. It wasn't our type of music. And we didn't listen to this music. It was just on the radio. We never bought this music. Yes. This is not music we would buy.
Not a fan, but also the music was poppy enough.
I don't know. Would it be that...
It chased me away
from... We were kind of a fan if it's on the radio. Would you agree with that? But it would never be something that I hope that Hall & Oates song comes. Even thinking I hope that Hall & Oates song comes on the radio.
You know why it bothered me on the radio? I think it was the same thing for other bands. Like at the time, they were played all the time, and I didn't think they deserved that much play from my point of view.
That's a very good point.
And I think that's where a bit of my Hall & Oates aversion comes from.
You know what? I agree with that. That's a good point that I may have thought of in the past.
In the 80s,
but
when we were...
I agree with that.
And at the
I have to say that his Daryl Hall's voice has to be listened to in an album context because it's on the album song sometimes that he just... My God, it's breathtaking. Like, it's like, how can he hold that note and yet hold the note with the same... Like, not the length, not only the length, but to keep the key, you know, the same is stunning sometimes. Yeah. And you don't get that on the singles because you don't get that chance on the singles to do that. It's usually 3.5 minutes or whatever, and it's a single. But you listen to an album like this, and if there's one thing, I think maybe the only thing that you can take from this album is the appreciation of how good he really is as a singer.
Yes, it did surprise me because, like I say, I heard him from the pop songs. I didn't think he was that... I didn't think he was bad. I thought he was okay, but I thought okay was all he was, and I was wrong. He's good.
So there wasn't... You liked... You basically... You kind of liked, in a way, I'm watching you and
tried
maybe.
And tried. And
but there wasn't really anything that you liked about this other than two songs, really. In a way.
1.5 songs.
Yeah. One whole song of War Baby and a half of I'm Watching You. And I have to admit, I'm surprised. I thought this album kind of... If you had to say what the general consensus was, you would probably say over the last 50 years, it has been a 2.5 to 3-star record. So I thought that mine was a little bit better than the consensus.
Optimistic.
And I think yours is worse than the consensus. So it's funny, we had the two spectrums. I'm being really generous with this album. And you're, because I said, I know, I kind of really like this album. And I thought, well, you're either going to agree with me or you're going to think, you know, it's good. But no, I didn't think it'd be 1.5. So we went for the spectrum from being not in the consensus is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I'm not saying this is a bad album. I'm saying it's one that didn't reach me.
You are. It's a 1.5-star album.
That's yes, to album. Me, it's a bad
yeah,
album.
Yeah, be honest, because it's okay. I mean, it's that's how you feel. That's how you feel. Sometimes you're too kind with these people.
Yeah, I gotta slap them around.
They got millions of dollars, man. And
that's, the point I'm trying to make is that I was trying way too hard to find stuff to like.
And you couldn't.
And I couldn't.
Yeah.
I couldn't.
Hey, that's a 1.5-star record. If you try and find something.
If I'm struggling
yes, to find and you still something can't to find like, it at the end, then it's a bad album.
That's where it gets its rating from me.
So I actually, on our consensus between me and Rob, we actually, I don't think we can recommend this album to anybody except... Not even to a Hall & Oates fan. I don't know. Yeah, I think a Hall & Oates fan would like it if they listen to it.
If you like experimental music, this is kind of interesting.
I thought it was a very good album, but I don't know if I can recommend. I don't know who would like this, to be honest with you, except a person like me.
I can't recommend it because I wouldn't know what I'd be recommending it for.
Right. You know who I'd recommend this to? Big Todd Rundgren fans. That's the only people that I seriously can say that I can recommend this to, and I would know that they would like it. They might even think it's what you said a little bit, but there's so much Todd Rundgren in it that they could overlook. Plus, we should say not only Daryl Hall's, we said this already, but I just want to make a point. Not only was the highlight Daryl Hall's vocals, but Todd Rundgren's lead guitar doesn't make it worth buying, but it was a great lead guitar.
Still, boy, some good playing.
This is an album that, and usually I'll say, oh, this is. You know, this did get good reviews, but you should pick it up. Me and Rob recommend it. I think me and Rob both say, I don't know who this is for. And Rob says it in a bad.
You
Rob
might says like it, but I can't recommend it.
We can't recommend this. And I don't say that in a bad way because I like this record. But I also recognize there's not one hit song on this record. Like I said before, I would begrudgingly say one song could be released as a single if I had to make that choice. But this is a singles band, and I can't find a song on there because it's not one strong enough. And I think it's too weird for some people. And I don't know what audience is going to listen to this. I don't know the audience in 1974, and I don't know the audience now. It's a difficult album because it's eccentric. It's not a weird, it's just eccentric in a radio type of way.
So for the two Todd Rundgren albums we've reviewed, produced, that seems to be a common thread.
Yes.
These are not like the other albums.
These are not. That's a very good point. The two albums that we have done so far, of course, last week we did Meatloaf and today we did Hall & Oates.
They don't fit
in. Is that they don't fit into any sort of category that we can even identify. And you're talking with people who know their stuff. And even us, it's not a big deal with Meatloaf because everybody says that. What is this? They've been talking about that for almost 40 years now, 35, 40 years, 50 years, I should say. I'm sorry, 77. So almost 50 years old. People still always say, well, it's an unclassifiable album. It is a rock album, but it's so much more than that. And in some ways, it's less than that, depending on how you look at the music. There is no way that other than a Todd Rundgren, even though I like the album, that I can recommend it to anybody except a Todd Rundgren fan. I wouldn't even recommend it to a Hall & Oates fan because they might get mad. I don't know.
If you're a Hall & Oates fan, I don't think this will disappoint you.
But you know what? That's why, out of all the Todd Rundgren produced albums that I could have chose for the three, I picked this one because I knew it was controversial. And it was controversial for the reasons that I stated, not because of the what people think is controversial, which was why it was made, what the hell's going on. It's because the music is so, I don't know.
Yeah, if it's in the background, it can be identified as rock music.
Yes.
If you're listening to it up front and it's right there, it's something different.
If you're an adventurous person, I definitely recommend picking this up because I liked it. But if you're not into adventurous pop songwriting,
yeah, yeah,
stay away from this.
This is not for you.
This is not for you.
Back off. Back off.
Okay, again, we hit the mark that we always hit. We never even try. That's our show for today.
We are consistent.
Very fascinating show today, actually. A fascinating show. I love not only when we disagree, because we don't really disagree that often, but I love when we disagree because, unlike most people that I disagree with, we both have real good reasons why. Yeah. They're not just, I don't know, it was just, yeah.
I like it. I hate it.
I couldn't dance to it. Yeah, I like it. I hate it. Yeah, it's very good. It's not there, like that.
That's the show. Done.
There, we make sure there's specific points why we disagreed on this album. And you know what? I agree with his points as far as I understand it. Some of them I don't agree with, that I said it doesn't bother me, but that doesn't mean it's not there. You know what I mean? It depends on the person listening. And and he brought up, Rob brought up a very good point about the repeating, which I had, it didn't bother me, so I never thought about it, but it is there. And so very fascinating show today. Again, that's why I picked it, because I thought this album would be fascinating to review, and it has been. Next week should be more clear cut. Anyways.
That's enough of the show. We've gone too long. We're blathering at this point. We're falling at the mouth.
You gotta wait till next week. Next week we will have the final album on our theme of Todd Rundgren produced albums, and I have my fork and knives ready to cut it up. Or will I, Rob? Or will I love it? You have to listen to it. Trust me. If you've liked the last 2 weeks, you have to listen to next week's episode. To find out. Next week's episode, of course, is called Murder is a Record Best Produced by Todd Rundgren. Act One. for all you 70s cop show fans out there. So, until this has been a great show. This has been one of my favorite shows, I think. So, until then, take care and everybody stay safe. Just right on. So we're going to do it without a dink?
Strategy. I think we may have to do without a dink because no dink is available. We are dinkless.